This week on World Affairs, is the American dream an outdated one? I'm Philip Yun, CEO of World Affairs. The United States is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, yet 1 in 7 Americans lives below the poverty line, and countless others struggle with the issue of addiction or depression. What policies led to the creation of such a polarized society within the United States? Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn are best known for their groundbreaking coverage of international and human rights issues. Now they're calling for urgent attention to a crisis here at home. It's the crisis of working-class America. In this episode of World Affairs, a Pulitzer Prize-winning couple discussed their latest book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Moderating the program in front of a live audience at the World Affairs Center in San Francisco is Mina Kim, KQED anchor and host of Friday Forum. Our weekly broadcast is produced in partnership with KQED and is made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG.
Thank you so much for joining us. It is such a great pleasure for me to be able to have this conversation with Nick and Cheryl about their book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. And I actually want to start by pulling a little bit from the second chapter of your book, which was titled, We're Number 61. And it's where you write, we, Americans, proudly assert we're number one. And in terms of overall economic and military strength, we are. But in other respects, you write, our self-confidence is delusional. America ranks number 40 in child mortality, number 32 in internet access, 39 in access to clean drinking water, and number 61 in high school enrollment. That's out of the 146 countries covered by the Social Progress Index. And Kristof and Wu Dunn write, somehow we're number 61 doesn't seem so proud a boast. I share these statistics not only to emphasize how a certain American narrative can mask huge realities or fundamental problems, but also to say that this book, what it really does beautifully is tell the stories of the people who are living these statistics. And part of the reason that you're able to do this in such a personal and beautiful way is because you are talking about people, in your case, Nick Kristof, that you grew up with. So start by telling us about where you grew up. Tell us about Yamhill, Oregon.
Well, as an Oregonian, I should say that it's great to be back on the best coast. Even if we're slightly south of the absolute epicenter of God's country. So Yamhill is a little farm town, population 1,000 on a good day, southwest of Portland, very edge of the Willamette Valley going into the coastal range. Traditionally, the economy was dependent on agriculture, timber, and light manufacturing. The biggest employer was a glove factory. It's an area that had done spectacularly well for many, many decades. And everybody was looking forward to that continuing to rise. So we tell the story partly through my number 6 school bus, full of working class kids whose families had done well. The family that got on the bus right after me was the Knapps, whose dad was he had a union job laying sewer pipes. The mom worked on a farm, driving tractor. And Farlan was my year, very smart, capable kid. All the kids were capable. But the jobs went away. Lives imploded. A quarter of the kids on the number 6 bus are now gone because of drugs, alcohol, and suicide. Farlan died of liver failure from drug and alcohol use. Zeeland died in a house fire when he was passed out drunk. Regina died of hepatitis from injectable drug use. And Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. The only survivor of the 5 was the youngest, Keelan, and he survived only because he spent 13 years in the Oregon State Penitentiary. That's one family on my bus, and there were a lot more that those kids just went through an inferno.
And Cheryl, I mean, you have been and visited Yamhill for decades. You've been there when you and Nick got engaged, and you've lived there even for a brief period of time. When did you start to say to yourself that there's something going on here that isn't just specific to Yamhill, that is worth exploring?
Well, first we had to figure out that actually something was going on in Yamhill that we hadn't expected. So we had been covering, when we were foreign correspondents, covering, you know, lots of different things, including humanitarian crises. And then we would come back to Yamhill every year, and we would talk to a lot of the people who worked on the farm, the family farm, you know, people who were, you know, Nick's old friends. We would chat with them. And, you know, over time, we started to realize, oh, well, you know, Rick Goff died of, you know, disease related to his drug abuse. You know, his son is in prison. You know, Kevin Green died of, you know, obesity related to, you know, meth and other drug abuse as well. And we start to realize that there was a humanitarian crisis unfolding in Yamhill. And it only was when we started probing, and you really have to go behind closed doors. These are not issues that people will talk about regularly. So when they started opening up their homes, we could talk to them about it. But we also wanted to find out, is this just Yamhill? And so we actually went to other, you know, states. We went to lots of different areas, urban and rural. We went to Arkansas, Tennessee, Oklahoma. We went to Baltimore. We went to Virginia. And it really is nationwide. And in fact, some research really shows how nationwide it is. Ann Case and Angus Deaton have really looked at census data, and they discovered that while mortality rates are falling, we are, you know, progressing as a world. Most areas of the U.S., mortality rates are falling, except for the working class whites and blacks. Basically, mortality rates are rising.
And I want to underscore the point that you were making about how you tried to see if this wasn't just specific to Yamhill, which is a predominantly white town. And you went to, say, for example, Baltimore, where you were in predominantly black communities, and still finding consistencies. And I love this one line in your book where you talk about, you know, the Knapps, sure, they made some mistakes. And you talk about the decision to drop out of high school, for example, as being something that may have set them on a path that would have made life very difficult. But you also point out that they were not less talented or less hardworking than their grandparents' generation. So what happened over the course of your generation that would lead to ultimately 4 of the 5 Knapp children dying and so many other people really falling off the tightrope, essentially?
So, as you say, Yamhill is lily white. And in Yamhill, and I think in a lot of white communities in the 1990s, there were a lot of disparaging comments made about African Americans and the struggles in African American communities. And people would talk about how the problems were a result of deadbeat dads and people making bad choices and not showing personal responsibility, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And meanwhile, the great Harvard sociologist, William Julius Wilson, argued that, no, it's because of lost jobs. And these pathologies are a consequence of lost jobs. He was exactly right. Because when jobs left Yamhill, and when they left Kentucky, when they left Maine, the same patterns unfolded. And so it was, I think, a function of lost jobs and of declining returns for basically the bottom half of the labor force, who today are, if you're at the bottom end of the labor force, you're earning less than you were adjusted for inflation in the 1970s.
And the science is getting better showing that there is a strong correlation between economic despair and opioid use, alcoholism, suicide, and things like that. So they haven't found necessarily a causal connection, but the correlations are showing up very consistently.
Well, there's some really interesting research on early childhood, experiences. And so there's something called adverse child experiences, the ACEs. And in fact, your, you know, first Surgeon General, Linda Burke-Harris, has done some great research that shows that, you know, most of us have one or two ACEs when we're, you know, a young child. It could be anything. I mean, if parents getting divorced or, you know, something happening, you know. But when they start piling up, When you get like 3, 4, 5, 6 ACEs, which a lot of these troubled kids have when they're growing up, so these are in the early years, then not only is it easier to predict that, you know, a couple decades later they might not graduate from high school or they might have a troubled teen years. So the emotional disturbance is pretty, pretty clear. But what they also are finding, which is remarkable, is that health-wise, their health, they can predict they're going to more likely have heart disease, more likely have chronic diseases like diabetes, and obesity. So this also poses huge challenges for society when, you know, a lot of these can be corrected when they're in, you know, young children, and when it's much cheaper to sort of do course correction than when they're adults later on with all these diseases that, you know, basically the costs to society are quite large.
So then, Nick, how did you get out? Or, you know, how were you able to eke out this very successful life growing up with a class status that wasn't all that different from your counterparts?
So, if you look at the kids in my National Honor, in the school yearbook in the National Honor Society, they basically all did just great. The kids who dropped out of high school, on the other hand, which was a large contingent, they did catastrophically, and others were somewhere in between. So there wasn't a huge economic difference among different families. There was an extraordinary difference in childhoods, in ACEs, in devotion to education. So we tend to measure poverty with metrics of income or wealth. A far better measure for Yamhill in terms of predicting long-term outcomes would have been number of children's books in the house, how often you're read to, how often you're hugged, how much violence there is in the home. Those, you know, I was in a home abounding with books, read to all the time, deeply committed to education. And there were a lot of others whose parents were not well educated. And I mean, the Knapps, the dad had almost no education. The mom had a fifth grade education. And the kids, I think, thought that their dad had had a good union job without graduating from high school and that they didn't really need to either. And the parents themselves, I think, didn't fully appreciate the importance of that education. And so I look at, you know, if I'd been in the Knapp household and if Farland had been in my household, our outcomes might not have been exactly reversed, but I would not be here if I had grown up in Farland's home.
But then, Cheryl, that gives fodder to the argument that it's about the family, it's about personal responsibility. And so how do you reconcile that with what you're also calling for, which is really broad, fundamental shifts in federal policy, state policy, to be able to create a stronger safety net for people?
So, you know, it's not 100% nature or 100% nurture. It's really a combination. It's that blend, which is really hard. Look, it's not a science, it's an art. And so basically, you know, Nick also had good genes, and so there was part of that. But he also had a very nurturing, you know, experience in high school. So his teachers loved him, and he sort of responded to that. And I think that's very true. So, you know, what we're saying is that in the past, and I think there we are seeing change, is that, you know, think about school truancy when the kids actually were troublemakers, and basically the school just, you know, kicked them out. But what happened was that then they became society's problems, not the school's problem. Now we're seeing, certainly in Yamhill, that they're trying to keep the kids in because they know that the kids who are troublemakers are the ones who actually need the school more. They still do suspend people when it's just, you know, look, they're not a social services, organization. They are an educational organization. But they understand they're trying to do their best to bring in, to keep some of the children. So what they're seeing now is that in kindergarten, they're seeing some of these kids, they're calling feral, you know, like wild dogs and cats. And so when I first heard that, I said, wait, what do you mean by kids who are feral? So they've never been in society. They're not socialized. They don't know how to, you know, make friends. They don't know how to react, how to interact with other people. They are just feral. That's the only way we can describe them. They're so sort of green. And that's scary because that means that this is the future generation. And unless some organization tries to work with them, they're not getting it at home. So, you know, you won't get a total reversal, as Nick said, you know, Farland and him, but you'll actually do much better with them if society can actually help.
But I think what I'm struck by in your book, besides the fact that you do try to nod to the argument of personal responsibility, is that you're actually saying that that argument, right, is in fact like
part of the problem.
Part of the problem that it's responsible for so much of the narrative that has been guiding our policy decisions and guiding people's assessments of themselves and their own successes. So can you explain that?
I think the social narrative, personal responsibility, is one of the main reasons we've ended up with really bad policies. And it has also been internalized by many of those who struggle. And the result is that when they struggle, they think, I know, I screwed up. I'm not doing as well as my dad did a generation earlier. And the result has been self-medication and a downward spiral. And kind of a mental health crisis, which much of this mental health crisis is closely linked to this economic crisis. And, you know, the notion that could have spread sort of in the 1970s and on, that people can just lift themselves up by the bootstraps, is anybody tried to do that? Anybody understand the physics of lifting yourself up by the bootstraps? You know, in the 18th century and 19th century, to lift yourself up by the bootstraps, that expression meant the exact opposite of what it does today. At that point, it meant something magical. It was only in the 20th century that it took on the meaning of, the didactic meaning of, you know, lifting yourself up. You know, when you can predict long-term outcomes based on the zip code that a child is born in, then it's not because that infant is making bad choices or showing lack of personal responsibility. It's because we as a society are making bad choices about the opportunities that we make available to those infants, to those children. And so, by all means, let's have a conversation about personal responsibility. It's real. Farland would have absolutely acknowledged that. But if we're going to have that conversation, let's also have a conversation about our collective social responsibility to help disadvantaged kids.
You know, what's really remarkable is that we somehow have said people who are, you know, impoverished in the bottom, you know, 50% even, that, you know, they shouldn't get second or third or fourth chances. But we give, you know, lots of people, business, you know, executives, third, fourth, fifth chances all the time. So why, you know, even they can become president. So why can't we give, you know, people, you know, who are, you know, less, you know, advantaged, a leg up. And that's really important because, you know, let me tell you a story about, you know, what happened when Bill Gates went to Saudi Arabia. He basically was giving a talk. There were 2/3 of the audience were men. There was a physical barrier, and then the other third were women, and they were covered. But they had to separate the men and the women because, you know, heaven forbid, right, them being in the same room. So then he was giving the talk, and a man stood up and said, Mr. Gates, we have as our goal in Saudi Arabia to become one of the top 10 economies of the world. Do you think we'll make it? And Bill Gates, as he's staring out at the audience, he says, if you're not fully utilizing half the resources in your country, there is no way you'll get anywhere near the top 10. Well, the same is true in America. If we are no way, you know, fully utilizing all the potential of Americans, we are not going to stay number one. We need all Americans firing on all pistons.
I do want to just step back a little bit and talk about the experience for both of you to tell the stories of your friends, especially in light of understanding the strength of this American narrative of pull yourself up by the bootstraps, of personal responsibility, that when you share their stories, that you are ultimately also subjecting them potentially to scorn. Anytime you're telling someone's story, you want to do right by them while at the same time you're needing to tell something that may not reflect them in the greatest light, to be able to inspire people to move toward action. When you wrote about the naps, you did get some very
horrible comments.
Yes.
About people I cared deeply about. And so this was a very hard book to write in that sense. You know, we wrote about refugees in South Sudan, and you have that distance, that armor. You don't when you're writing about your seventh grade crush. And you, we worried about how they would read what we wrote. They tend to be very conservative politically, and I think we'll disagree with a lot of our long-term solutions and analyses. And they really trusted us and told us some deeply embarrassing things about themselves and their lives and mistakes they'd made. We also worried about, you know, just, I love Yamhill. I don't want you all to think that it's this place where everybody's cooking meth and dying early. It's an amazing, wonderful place. And so trying to navigate all this and presenting people in their full, rounded complexity, and yet also in a way that respects them and gives them dignity, was a huge challenge. You know, people like the Knapps or our friends, the Greens, who we also write a lot about, they don't want your sympathy. What they want is your respect, and they want dignity. They want to be treated as if they exist. And I think there is a feeling among a lot of this demographic that they are going through this Great Depression and dying in enormous numbers, and nobody's noticing. And people are off partying in the first-class cabin. So that was a challenge. We just had a text from my seventh grade crush yesterday that she's almost all the way through it and really, you know, has been weeping, but also has really loved it. And so, and that's kind of in general the reaction so far, which leaves us very relieved.
I think the other reason that some people have said to us, I mean, not just in Yamhill and other places, and, you know, they're really talking about these horrible things that they did. But they say, you know, if my story can actually help others avoid taking the same path I did, then I will feel really, really good. And that's the way they're giving back. And I think that that was just so powerful to us, that I want to tell my story so that others don't do this.
Mm. You know, one of the comments that you kind of rebutted in another piece, Nick, in the New York Times, was someone saying, like, oh, this is natural selection at work, these people who are unfit for survival getting weeded out. But I think the other thing that I was interested about in Cheryl and Nick in your book was just that you also make it clear that there is a lack of empathy on the left, in the sense of, these people just vote against their own interests all the time. I mean, you just mentioned that they're probably not going to agree with your policy prescriptions, and they're probably going to agree with policy prescriptions that may, or that are at least being championed by, you know, people on the right, that may further entrench this situation, but that there is very little empathy on the left for that. It's like, oh, you voted against your interests? This is what you get for it. Like, live with it.
Yeah, this is a demographic that has kind of been scorned by every which direction, because conservatives tend to rail at them for making bad choices in the sense of, you know, bad lifestyle choices, and liberals tend to rail at them for making bad political choices and voting against their economic interests, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's really important that Democrats not give up on this demographic. You know, there were roughly 8 million people who voted for Obama in 2012, who then voted for President Trump in 2016. The white working class tends to be socially conservative on issues like guns, like abortion, but it tends to be economically liberal on issues like the minimum wage, on parental leave, on early childhood. It's important to fight for these voters. Bobby Kennedy was fantastic at reaching out in a way that was empathetic and not condescending. And I hope that whoever the Democratic nominee is will again reach out. And, you know, obviously many will not vote for the Democratic nominee because of issues like abortion and guns. But there is a fighting chance to win both in the presidential election and in Senate elections when a share of that vote.
So what are the solutions? I mean, Cheryl, start us off. What do you see as sort of the top three fundamental things that need to change in terms of the way that we approach poverty and working class Americans?
Well, there are several things. So first of all, early childhood education, we talked about the ACEs, and so how it is so much more cost effective to really try and take a young baby when the brain is growing at the fastest pace it ever will be, and the brain architecture is forming. If you can actually capture that child before all the cortisol and the stress hormones impair the development of the brain architecture, then you are so much better off in, you know, putting that kid, child, onto a better life path. So early preschool, early childhood education, and, you know, universal pre-K is, we think, is really important. Now, obviously, you have to have high quality. You know, it's not like just slap up, put them all in a room, and that's it. The second, I would say, is that, you know, drug rehabilitation with the deaths of despair and the numbers. I mean, 68,000 last year people died of drug overdoses. I mean, that's just more every, you know, more people dying, you know, more people dying in 2 weeks from drug overdoses than died in 18 years of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, that's just a stunning figure. And how much we've spent $2 trillion on those two wars and nowhere near that on drug rehabilitation. So drug rehabilitation, and there's some great programs. We talk about one called Women in Recovery in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where instead of women sending them to jail or to prison, if the underlying cause is really for them committing the crime is really, you know, some addiction, then let's send them to drug rehab, which is what they really need. That's, you know, what was done in Portugal very successfully. We need to course correct when we see that there's a problem with our war on drugs and our mass incarceration. When there's a mistake, we should course correct and improve it. And there's lots of evidence that shows that our approach to dealing with drugs, lock them up, is not working. And in fact, if you actually put them into drug rehabilitation, that works much better. And the third thing I would do is have to do with jobs, because we discovered as we were writing this book that jobs were the trigger for so many, you know, malaise. It's not just a loss of income, which is substantial, but also a loss of health care, which you don't have in other countries. And we sort of compare what happens in a country like, you know, Canada to here when people lose their jobs. Auto workers lose their jobs after the financial crisis. Americans lost their health care. They got a little bit more money for unemployment benefits, but the Canadians didn't lose their health care. And the government helped them find other job, you know, areas. They set up retraining programs for them to find jobs in nursing. These are auto workers, welders who might go into nursing. But it was okay because they got jobs. And we don't do enough of that. And we don't understand the importance of jobs. It's not just income. It's also identity. It's purpose. It's a sense of, you know, well-being. And so I think that jobs are much more critical.
Can I just add something? Yes. I completely agree with those choices, but I also think that the fundamental challenge to getting better policies is also tackling the social narratives that we have that are such an impediment to better policies. And these two interconnected narratives, one, the obsession with personal responsibility, and another, a narrative that has been promulgated particularly since the Reagan presidency, is that government essentially can't do anything right, that it's all about what the individual can do. And, you know, growing up in Oregon, we were nurtured on all the heroism of the pioneers on the Oregon Trail. And they were heroic, and they were courageous. But why did the pioneers cross the country to get to the Willamette Valley? because of a government benefit program. Because they knew that if they got there, they would get 640 acres. We had a particularly generous homestead program in Oregon. And something like a quarter of the wealth of white families, a quarter of white families in America have some family wealth that derived from the homestead program. It was an incredible program to create wealth, to support disadvantaged Americans at that time. Later, America was transformed by the creation of mass high schools, great secondary education that was very widespread. Later on, rural electrification. Later on, the GI Bill of Rights, putting people in homes and giving them an education. And that, too, is very much a part of the American history, but it's one that we have largely left behind over the last 50 years. We don't really talk about bandwidth for all. You know, we have made tertiary education less available over time as it's harder to work through college. And so I'd love to go back to that narrative about government helping to create opportunities, investing in human capital, laying a foundation for inclusive growth.
It's so interesting you say that, because one of the questions I had was, well, you're writers, right? If you could rewrite that American narrative, what would it be?
So it would be that government programs like those I mentioned can create opportunities and transform the lives of individuals, and that it's not just about the individual on the tightrope. There's also, you know, I think a false narrative, maybe particularly in the Bay Area, that this is all about automation and industrialization and globalization. And I think that's not correct. This is fundamentally about bad policy choices that we made as a country. Germany, Canada, they faced automation and globalization, but they do not have life expectancy falling for 3 years in a row. And when Ben Carson talks about, he says, poverty is really just a choice, you know, he's right in some sense, not in the way he means, but we as a country have chosen, okay, we're not going to invest in early childhood education the way so many other countries do. We're not going to ensure a quality of education as every other country in the OECD does. We're not going to provide family leave the way every other industrialized country does. So, yeah, these are our choices. And if we want better results, then I think we're going to have to make new choices.
I think that part of it would be that we also have to talk about collective social responsibility. You know, right now, you know, if a baby, we can already predict with very good accuracy what zip code he's born in, then he's going to be 2 decades later, you know, a troubled youth, then how much of it is really his fault? I mean, in Shannon County now, Shannon County in South Dakota, a baby born in Shannon County, South Dakota, has a life expectancy that is shorter than a baby born in Cambodia and Bangladesh. So, you know, are you blaming that infant, you know, at birth, that it's his fault for having a shorter life expectancy? So there's something going on in society. So I think that collective social responsibility is really important.
You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yun. We're hearing New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and business executive and journalist Cheryl Wu Dunn discuss their new book, Tightrope: Americans Reaching for Hope. Moderating the program is Mina Kim, KQED anchor and host of Friday Forum. To hear this program or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to our program.
We've been collecting some of the questions from the audience, and I wanted to bring them into the conversation, and it was so funny because the very first one, I shuffled them a little bit, was a question about globalization, because I know you take this on directly, which is what you just did with this question of on the falling wages, for example. Do you see globalization over the last decades as being responsible? And you do talk about globalization having an impact, but you also, as you just did, compare it to other nations that are experiencing this and not having the same outcomes or issues. I think the same person asked a second question, which is, on lost jobs, why aren't people migrating to cities with new jobs in a country like the U.S. with so much mobility? Either one of you can take this. But in terms of movement,
there's definitely some of that going on. So we saw how people in Yamhill are moving to Idaho or, you know, to find better jobs. And that works to some degree, you know. But I still think that if you have a strong foundation with good education, that makes you a lot more resilient. So, you know, people move to Idaho. And then when the financial crisis hit, you know, they had to come back to Yamhill because the jobs were drying up there. And so I do think that still it really helps. But I think that migration isn't going to be the only answer. Education is really important. And then job retraining. So a lot of these people in their, you know, 30s or 40s, you know, they still have many years of work ahead of them. But if they're trained as a cement finisher, you know, like, unless there's lots of jobs in, you know, for cement finishers, what are they going to do? And so I do think that job retraining, as I mentioned in Canada, they do it very, very well. So we always give short shrift to job retraining. There's the only official, really official program is, you know, an economic assistance, a trade assistance program that, you know, really the money hasn't really been spent on retraining very well. We think, oh, retraining never works because it's only been like a several weeks. You know, if you do retraining seriously, as Germany, as other countries in Western Europe do, as Canada does, it can be very effective. Mm-hmm. And we need to keep retraining workers because the workplace is going to change. Jobs with technology and automation and globalization, they are going to change. So we have to be prepared and know that, you know, retraining is going to be important.
And I really love that story about Canada because I was born in Windsor, Ontario.
Oh, is that right?
You're kidding.
And so when they talked about, you basically had this case study of folks who were in the U.S. and those who were in Canada right at that Detroit border and how they fared so much better with the supports that they gave in Canada. Which political candidate do you think will be able to best implement some of your ideas? And I'm going to add another audience question to that, which is, do you think a guaranteed minimum income would have a positive effect on the economic problem, on the jobs issue that you described? So, because clearly there is one candidate who has championed universal basic income.
I'll take the minimum income and he can take the other one. So, of course, Andrew Yang is actually, you know, championed the universal basic income. And, you know, I support that if it's only a first step. I don't support if it's the end-all be-all because what we discovered is that you get some money, but the jobs really are important for identity, for purpose, for a sense of belonging, and the basic minimum income is just not going to cut it. But it is a first step because it does address a lot of issues. Child allowances are also another way of alleviating child poverty. So I think that's one thing that, and there have been experiments in other places in Western Europe where they've actually tried universal basic income, and so far they haven't found the right formula.
And I just want to say, in addition to being a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Cheryl Wudunn has an incredible background in finance and in business, so... So, Nick Kristof, this issue of, like, how is it playing out in the election? Are political candidates giving the issues that you're talking about attention, or at least the ones who are, you know, sort of been considered front runners right now?
So Bernie Sanders does speak to, he's just about the only candidate who refers to the working class as opposed to the middle class. But in general, I'd say that the candidates are much more focused on middle-class issues. So there has been a very healthy discussion about improving college access, which is great. It's an important issue. But fundamentally, we have to confront the fact that, in addition, 1 in 7 American kids doesn't graduate from high school still. Those kids are completely, you know, they're never going to get anywhere unless they can graduate from high school. And in terms of the ability of candidates to implement these issues, I'd say that fundamentally it depends. What's most important is getting elected and on winning the Senate. And I am an incredibly bad prognosticator on who is electable, because 4 years ago I would have said that the one clear thing we know is that Donald Trump is not electable. So I'm not even going to try to hazard a guess about in the Democratic field about who is more electable.
Sure. One thing I was struck by, though, is that when I was reading your solutions, I mean, the one candidate, or at least one candidate who's made this the centerpiece of his campaign in terms of early childhood education and investing in preschool is Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, and he's polling at like just above zero.
That's
you know,
right.
I mean, it just shows how, that has no traction. I mean, that message does not seem to have traction.
Because children don't vote.
That's right. The National Academies did a really very impressive study a year ago about how we could reduce child poverty in America by half. Spending about at a cost of about $100 billion a year, it would save about $1 trillion a year in expenses. And that study has gotten no attention. No candidate has followed. Michael Bennett has, he offers ideas that are drawn from it, like child allowances. But it is, you know, it's a reminder that what we lack isn't the toolboxes to address these issues. It's the political will. And there is also this problem that President Trump, we're all focused on Trump, on the impeachment trial. He sucks all the oxygen out of the room. And at the end of the day, these issues, they predated Donald Trump. They will be around after Trump is gone. Trump, in some ways, is a consequence of their existence. And I hope that we can save some bandwidth, not only for Trump, who obviously is important, I write about him all the time, but also for these larger issues about the disintegration of a huge share of American society.
Where do you think is the greatest potential for bipartisanship?
Well, I do think that a couple places. In early childhood education, you do have some red states doing phenomenally well. Tulsa, Oklahoma is one example. The early childhood education there is just really, really strong and could be a model for other cities. And so if we can actually, you know, both sides can say, wait a second, they've done it right, let's actually take it across nationwide, then that is one area of common ground that maybe then could be a stepping stone for others. I also think that Medicaid expansion is another area where we are seeing some commonality, partly because a lot of these, you know, voters who voted for Trump, they actually like their Medicaid. I mean, you know, people in Yamhill we talked to, I mean, they were using it. They were in the hospitals. They were in and out of the hospitals. They were just grateful that they had Medicaid paid. They had their hospital bills paid for. And, you know, if they can recognize that that is coming from, a need, you know, at least an effort to try and bring health care to all, I think that's another area where there is, you know, we could figure out a way with that allows both sides to save face, have common ground.
There is an interesting political argument that the calculations on some of these more enlightened policies may be changing. And remember that many of them, in some ways, were really rooted in racialization of politics and the Nixon Southern strategy. And kind of coded messaging warning that investments in human capital or benefit programs would disproportionately benefit African Americans. And that was, I think, also a major factor in the war on drugs and mass incarceration. These days, as so many whites are struggling with so many of these issues, you are seeing the framing changing, and you are seeing somewhat greater compassion directed to those who are suffering from these. So our language on narcotics has tended to shift away from things like junkies to people in need of treatment. And this is hypocritical. It's a double standard. But if it can lead to belatedly more compassionate and wise policies, then that is indeed a potential step forward. So,
but what we're hearing right now is definitely movement in the Trump administration to reinvigorate the war on drugs. I mean, that's the direction
and,
that they're talking about.
And the cruelty of some of these benefit programs to make, you know, people, if they want dental benefits, then to pay $1 a month as a premium, basically, which then costs more to administer. and to kick people off than it actually than you get from the dollars. Or Arkansas introduced a work requirement which required people who were, you know, on the margins to get I think it was it food stamps or Medicaid? I forget which, but to sustain it, that they had to go online and report, you know, every month that they were working in a country that in a state that, as I recall, ranked 49th in internet access. There's just a nastiness and a gratuitous cruelty to some of these requirements.
So then what's your response to people who say, we can't afford the things that you're talking about? I mean, you're talking about, I don't know, paying for free preschool for everyone or childcare or national health care to some extent and other huge...
Well, part of it can be paid for by, there's this example in New York City, a hedge fund mogul paid $238 million for a condo in the prime area of New York City, the heart of New York City. But he's paying property taxes as if that property were actually worth only $9.8 million. So that subsidy certainly could pay for quite a number of spots in a preschool. So I do think that there are corporate subsidies. There are subsidies for the rich that, the subsidy for yacht buying. I mean, a subsidy to buy a yacht. I mean, you know, the carried interest loophole, even hedge fund people were saying it's just ridiculous for us to get to pay our taxes at the capital gains rate on money that we say is really based on carried interest when it really is just our income. I mean, we should pay it, you know, just income tax the way everyone else does. So they actually closed the loophole for hedge funds, you know, because they made it for longer term. But that means the private equity guys get this carried interest loophole still. I mean, that's just ridiculous. So there is a lot of money that is there that, you know, the wealth tax people have talked about, that's one thing. But there's already so many, you know, pieces of, you know, pools of cash that can be had just in closing loopholes that we give, you know, unfairly, especially when we say that people on Medicaid, shouldn't have access to health care.
Yeah, I mean, there's a basic question of priorities. Do we want to fund a tax cut, or do we want to fund a program that will reduce child homelessness, poverty by half? Do we want to spend $3 trillion on wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or do we want to invest in the human capital of American kids? And those are priority questions for the country to face. This is indeed, poverty is a choice. And in addition, though, you know, many of these investments would pay for themselves and have been shown to pay for themselves. Early education for at-risk kids pays for itself, some studies say, 7 times over. Providing family planning for at-risk teenage girls pays for itself similarly. We're willing to pay $18,000 for a Medicaid childbirth, but not $300 for an IUD for a girl who wants it. They were willing to pay to incarcerate drug users, but not to provide treatment for them. Even though the drug treatment pays for every dollar invested in it, saves $12 down the road. So these are our choices we make as a country.
This person asks, your observations, recommendations are spot on, but in this room, you are preaching to the choir. How do we change minds so we can elect leaders that institute good policy? And then I'm going to couple that with Gail Donsky. Not everybody wrote their names on their questions, but I want to make sure to acknowledge those who do. And Gail writes, what did Bobby Kennedy do that was so effective in reaching out to this conservative social but low-income population? Can you train the Democratic presidential candidate?
Spread the word. I mean, if each one of us, we have our own friend contacts and our friend networks, if we just sort of propagate the word that, you know, that we also should reach across the aisle. I mean, if each person tried to reach across the aisle and step out of the bubble and reach across the aisle to someone different, that would be really terrific. I mean, I was raised in a Republican household, and so, you know, I obviously grew up a little bit more independent from my parents, but, you know, we do have conversations. We did have conversations a lot, and I was able to switch the channel from Fox News every once in a while to, you know, CNN. So little things like that. But I do think that having more conversations with people, is really important.
Bobby Kennedy stood out because he went out to areas that had been neglected, and he listened to people. And so he made his trip to Appalachia, et cetera, et cetera. And he didn't tell people, you're voting against your economic interests. He didn't instruct people. He listened. And that was very powerful. I think that we can do more of that. President Trump, frankly, in 2016, was quite good at speaking to people who'd been left behind and acknowledging their suffering. He then, you know, pointed to scapegoats and made scapegoats of people. But that wasn't an essential part, an essential ingredient. One can also point to other avenues to improve lives, like higher minimum wages. You know, I think that there are things one can learn from the Bobby Kennedys out there.
Your book is out there. You mentioned that the people that are in the book are reading it and moved by it. Do you think they're also moved in terms of some of the things that you and Cheryl recommend in terms of policy prescriptions? Or do you think, as you pointed out in your book, that there's this internalization of the narrative of personal responsibility where they come to just blame themselves and don't see these larger social safety nets that you're trying to strengthen, you know, as being the way to go?
Yeah, I think people are ambivalent, and they have internalized the narrative of personal responsibility, but they also see people around them dying and not getting help and not getting treatment, and they've run through this frantic thing where they have a loved one who has an addiction, and they frantically go one place to another place to another place and, you know, get told crazy things like, oh, well, their addiction isn't serious enough to be admitted into this program. And so there is a frustration with the way programs have failed. And I'm not sure about this, but in my more optimistic moments, I wonder if we may be approaching a turning point. You know, basically for 50 years in this country, we've had a trajectory of cutting taxes and cutting investments in human capital. And that kind of reached its apex in Kansas under Governor Sam Brownback. And Kansas schools were so devastated that Kansas Republicans rebelled and said, tax us more because our schools just cannot be this bad. We have to do this for the future of our state. I wonder whether historians may not look back at what happened in Kansas and see that as a moment when this national tide turned and people looked around and said, no, this model is not working. Well, you look at much of the South, which had a similar model of deregulate, bring in manufacturing. You know, it worked for a while, and now so many of these states have unbelievable environmental problems, and they don't have the human capital so that when tech companies are looking for cheaper places to operate, they're not looking in Mississippi. They're not looking in Alabama. And so maybe this country is ready to try to rectify what we argue was a historic wrong turn made over the last 50 years.
You've written multiple books together, each extraordinary. What are the challenges of both having a successful marriage and a successful writing partnership?
people
who wants to go first? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, you can go.
So people always wonder how we manage to write books together and stay married. And the truth is that if you raise kids together and stay married, a book is a piece of cake. You know, you can put a book down at night, a manuscript down at night, and it stays down. We found, I think, in our books that having two different voices, two different sets of experiences, enriches the end product. So we each write separate sections and the other edits it. And fortunately, we're each pretty good about being edited by the other.
I'm just going to end with this question. And can I just say, amazing questions from this audience. Peter writes, where do you see a seventh grader in Yamhill in 2020, 10 or 15 years from now, given current conditions?
I really think it depends on the seventh grader's household and family. If that is a family that has been educated, that believes deeply in education, that is reading to their child, hugging their child, that kid, I think, is going to do just fine. I really do. If that child is, there is a family that we are following closely in Yamhill because the grandfather was a dear friend of mine who has passed away, and the kids are little, five kids from four dads, raised by a mom who's now got a different boyfriend. The mom had almost no formal education, a few months of formal education. She's very smart, but only had a few months of formal education. When the oldest child was in kindergarten, he was expelled twice from kindergarten, once for stealing the teacher's iPad, once for being disruptive. Then the mom decided that she was deeply embarrassed. She decided that she was going to homeschool these five kids herself, even though she only has a few months of formal education. And my heart just breaks for these kids. And that those kids, you know, they're smart, they're talented, but I'm not optimistic about them.
But I actually would also add that Yamhill Schools is doing something really remarkable. Because the superintendent of schools is someone who was born, his father was an alcoholic, his household was dysfunctional. He says dysfunctional. He said what saved him was that he went into the Army, and he learned discipline, he learned skills, he came out, and he's phenomenal. So now he's the superintendent of schools there, and he understands the problems that a lot of these working-class kids are going through. And so they're trying not to kick the students out right away. As I mentioned earlier, you know, those are the kids who actually he knows need the help. He's also trying to build the modern version of a vocational training program in high school so that at least if they can stay in school for 1 or 2 years, they'll get some skills that will actually, you know, allow them to get a job. And he's working with local employers to find out exactly what kind of skills they have. So they're doing all sorts of things that I think are trying to help these students, you know, and give them the best shot that they can at making it.
On behalf of World Affairs, I ask you to join me in thanking Nick and Cheryl for this excellent discussion.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We're more than a program. We're a nonprofit membership organization that is dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter, and to giving you the tools and knowledge to navigate our rapidly transforming world. Please join our community and visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. Their new book is Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. They were in conversation with Mina Kim, KQED anchor and host of Friday Forum. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Jared Sport, and our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.